A fascinating tale of seduction, murder, fraud, coercion, and the trial of the Minneapolis Monster. My guest today is Sean Francis Peters, author of The Infamous Harry Hayward, a true account of murder and mesmerism in Gilded Age Minneapolis. Welcome to the show, Sean.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here talking to you.
Going through the book, this guy was just evil.
He really was. There were so many. He was bad in so many different ways. He was a very versatile, evil person.
How much of the story of Harry Hayward did you know before deciding to write The Crime of the Century?
Just a little bit. You know, I kind of looked around, and the story, it kind of rang a bell a little bit. I just sort of had remembered that there was this famous murder and that it involved a woman named Kitty Ging. And I knew a little the kind of general outlines of it, but I didn't really know the depth of it until I really got into it. And then it really pulled me in. I thought it would be a pretty good book because I found myself really being immersed in it as I was putting it together.
What was that research like to sift through? Because this story was, well, we would now call viral, throughout the nation. You had to sift through transcripts and documents and newspaper stories. What was that research like, and how long did it take you to get through some of that stuff?
You know, it took several years, and I did the stuff that historians do. You know, we look at newspaper accounts, we look at, you know, letters, and the trial transcript was available. I looked and looked and looked, and I, just through complete serendipity, I found a copy of the trial transcript, which weirdly was at the Yale University Library. And it took several years to put all that together, and also to just kind of sort between fact and fiction. There were so many amazing, incredible stories about this guy and all the bad stuff that he did. And some of it was true, and some of it was not true. And the true stuff is great, so I didn't feel like I needed to really, you know, embellish. I wouldn't have embellished anyway, but there was no need to, because the truth was, you know, much more compelling than any fiction could have been.
Yeah, it really sounds like it. I mean, to be honest with you, I wasn't familiar with Harry Hayward, and started reading the book, and I am mesmerized, I guess I could say. And that's one of the terms that you use, mesmerism. And how did that play such a role in Harry's life?
So many people commented on Harry's apparent ability to, like, bend others to his will. He just had this, I don't know, a kind of unique ability to make people do stuff that they might otherwise not have done. And his brother said it, and just so many people talked about it. And it was believed, now whether or not I believe that, you know, mesmerism is true, and, you know, whether we can kind of almost hypnotize people into doing stuff is another matter. But lots of people believed it. Lots of people thought he had this ability, you know, in the way that Charles Manson, maybe in our times, was thought to control people and kind of compelled others to commit murders. That was the belief, widespread. It was taken as a given that Harry had that ability. And certainly if you look at the people who kind of got caught up in his orbit, they wound up doing stuff that, you know, they knew that they shouldn't have done, but because he was so persuasive and manipulative and cunning, he was able to get them to commit crimes.
Talk a little bit about Kitty Ging, the woman who was murdered.
Sure. And, you know, it's one admitted shortcoming of the book. We don't actually know a lot about Kitty because, unfortunately, she appears, her final act is kind of the first act of the book. She sort of appears as a corpse at the beginning. We know that she's a dressmaker. She grew up in upstate New York. She came to the Twin Cities and was part of this generation of female entrepreneurs, sort of. There weren't a lot of white-collar business opportunities for women, but one thing that they could do was become dressmakers. And so she worked for someone else for a while and accumulated some capital and was this rather successful dressmaker. She operated out of a building called the Syndicate Block in downtown Minneapolis, and by all accounts was a great person. Everyone liked her. Mm-hmm. No one thought that she was a study in contrast to Harry Hayward. For as bad as everybody thought Harry was, people really enjoyed Kitty and thought that she was a great person, and that actually just made the story all the more dramatic, that she was kind of this innocent person who sort of got caught up with Harry and paid the ultimate price.
And you know, what's interesting about that too is that she, as a woman at that time and being an entrepreneur, you would think would be sort of a stronger character, maybe stronger of will or mind, where someone like Harry seems like he would be more able to manipulate people that may tend to waffle a little bit more.
Yeah, you know, I think that she thought that she could handle it. I think she knew exactly who Harry was and what Harry was about. And I think that she thought, I know what I'm up against, and I'm a strong, independent person, and I can figure this out. And it's unfortunate. Mm-hmm. I wondered about this as well. She didn't. What happened to her and her murder? I don't think it came as a total surprise to her. I think that she sort of knew that he was bad news, and that trouble might kind of result from their relationship. But I really think that she thought, it was almost in a weird way, it's kind of ironic that her strength is maybe one of the things that got her into trouble, because I think that she thought, I know what this is, I know who this guy is, and I can handle myself. And unfortunately, that didn't prove to be the case.
No, it sure didn't. We're talking with Sean Francis Peters. He's the author of The Infamous Harry Hayward, a true account of murder and mesmerism in Gilded Age Minneapolis. And he was called the most depraved, cold-blooded murderer that ever walked God's footstool. I mean, those are some pretty heavy-duty words from back then. God's footstool. Amazing. But who was Harry? Where did he come from?
So, you know, he was born in Illinois, but then basically spent his formative years in Minneapolis. His father was a kind of a landlord and property owner, and he had a pretty, like, I don't know, regular middle-class upbringing. I thought about that, you know, what was there some childhood trauma or something strange had happened to him that turned him into this person? And the fact is, it's just the opposite. He had a very kind of standard, but like, if anything, kind of a privileged upbringing. And many people said later that that was the problem, actually, that no one had ever really said no to him, and that he had no boundaries. That the reason that he felt that he had no boundaries as an adult is because no one had ever stopped him from doing anything growing up. So he was this kind of playboy type. He gambled a lot. He womanized a lot. He didn't work a lot. And he just kind of, I don't know, he just sort of did his own thing and preyed on others for his own advancement and pleasure.
That's amazing. I mean, there's a part of that that sounds like he was a narcissist, but there's more to it.
That's a, like, one piece of the puzzle.
Yeah.
He's a there's a test that you can go through for psychopathy, you know, and there's 20 questions. And it's, you know, shows no empathy, has no long-term plans, exploits others. And Harry is just, you just look at Harry and you look at that list and you go, check, 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 every single characteristic of a psychopath. The term psychopath didn't come in to, like, usage until later, but he absolutely fit that bill to a T. He really, really only thought about himself. And I didn't want to overdo it. When I first got into the story, I was like, okay, everybody keeps saying these terrible things about Harry, but I'm sure that there were some things about him that, you know, he must have been a nice guy in some ways. But the answer is no, he just never did anything kind or empathetic at all. And that's what makes the book. I thought that the book, initially when I started, I thought it would be a little bit more about Kitty and the murder, and it is, but it's mainly about Harry and Harry's character and Harry's kind of evil exploits.
You know what's ironic about that is Harry would probably think that was cool.
Oh, he reveled in it. He reveled in the attention and in the glory. And he, you know, people, they kind of asked him, you know, towards the end of his life, you know, who are you? Who are you like? And he would come up with these comparisons that he was like Mephistopheles, you know, this mythical demonic figure, or Jekyll and Hyde. And so he didn't, he didn't run away from that reputation at all. He really, really owned it. And even he did this confession at the end of his life. And in his confession, he he laid it all out there. He talked about all of the stuff that he did, and he said, yeah, this is who I am, and I did it sort of for my own pleasure. That the he, yeah, he didn't run away from who he was.
Unbelievable. And he takes, he didn't pull the trigger, but he used a man, Klaus Blixt. That's quite the name.
Right.
What, how did Klaus get involved with doing Harry's bidding?
Poor Klaus. He was very, another kind of innocent person swept up in Harry's orbit. Klaus was basically like the maintenance man or the janitor in this Ozark Flats building where Harry lived. Harry's father actually owned the building. Harry lived there. Kitty lived there. And Harry figured out that he could make Blixt kind of his dupe. And so he implicated him in some lower-level criminal wrongdoing. They did some arson. And then he kept blackmailing him and blackmailing him. And so eventually Blixt, but it was kind of a combination of blackmailing and this like mind control that Harry, this ability that Harry had to manipulate others, where finally Harry said, you have to do this for me. You have to kill Kitty Ging. And Blixt, basically, his plea was, I did it, but I was under Harry's spell almost. And it turned out that Blixt actually wasn't, Blixt went to prison for life, but wasn't executed, even though he was the trigger man. Blixt actually pulled the trigger. He was punished more severely than Harry was.
And it sounds like, as I read the story, Harry talked to people about killing Kitty, well, not saying her name specifically, but and talked to insurance agents discussing accidental deaths.
Yeah, he was too clever for his own good. He thought that he could get away with it, and he just wasn't as circumspect as he should have been. And you're right, he spoke to insurance agents about, because that was the scheme. He was going to, he had had himself named the beneficiary of these life insurance policies, so with Kitty dead, he would collect. And he went around, asking, can I collect in the case of accidental death? What if it's a murder? And that came back to haunt him at his trial. He also even talked to a doctor about what would be the best place to shoot someone kill them. And so, unfortunately for Harry, that doctor stood up at his trial and said, "Yeah, Harry came and asked me." So he was described as kind of a master criminal. In some ways, he was, just by the sheer like volume and variety of the things that he did. But he also did some things in retrospect that maybe weren't as cunning as they could have been.
Mm-hmm. We are talking with Sean Peters. He is the author of The Infamous Harry Hayward, and it is a true life account of the Minneapolis Monster. And as you go through the book, because folks, you really want to read this book, you're going to find lots of references, of course, to Minneapolis, lots of landmarks, pictures that are fascinating to look at. One of the things that I also found interesting is it seems like, and maybe this is just my take, but it seems like officers, law enforcement, really knew he did it. It was just trying to get all the connections together, but it was a 7-week trial.
Yeah, and it was kind of the trial of the century at the time. People, not only the Minneapolis newspapers, but newspapers from all over the country, they just could not get enough of this story because of who Harry was and all of the various, things. It's kind of the height of yellow journalism in the 1890s, where these sensational crimes were really all over the news. So it went on for 7 weeks, and there were twists and turns and dramatic moments in the courtroom. It lived up to its billing as a trial. They actually had to move it. They couldn't have it in the Hennepin County Courthouse because the courthouse, the biggest courthouse in the state of Minnesota, couldn't hold all of the people and all of the media who wanted to be there. So they had to go to this Labor Temple building that had an even bigger space. So that's how intense the interest was. It went on for weeks and weeks, and there were the crowds were just packed outside the court, inside the court, everywhere. People could not get enough of this story. The media loved it. It was perfect. It sold so many newspapers. Circulation for all of the papers in Minnesota, in Minneapolis, especially in 1895, went up just because of Harry. He was like gold to the yellow journalists.
Well, and how much of that, as you did all that research, how much would you, what kind of percentage would you say was written about him that was fact as opposed to maybe a little bit of embellishment?
That's a good question. I don't know how I could, a significant portion of what was written about him was not true. I couldn't put a percentage on it, but I would read, you know, there would be stories about him committing other murders and being involved in all sorts of stuff that just wasn't, it just wasn't true. And I really tried to, that's why it's important to look at a variety of sources. If I just heard saw a rumor kind of reported once in a newspaper, I sort of didn't believe that. But if it came into the trial and it was reported and then Harry wrote this confession later in his life, those were the sources overlapped. Were things that I found more plausible. But like I said before, even the, you know, even when you narrow it down, those things are just so amazing and incredible. You know, he did a lot of counterfeiting. That was a thing that came up in the trial. And he was involved in this thing called a green goods scam where they would you know, cheat fellow counterfeiters. They would, you know, people would think they were getting counterfeit money, but they actually were getting bricks and sawdust. He did all sorts of stuff like that. And so it, the things that I can, I want to be careful to verify everything to make sure every word of the book is true. And that was plenty. I found plenty of stuff that I could verify that was just amazing. And there just really hasn't been anybody like Harry either before or since. And that's probably a good thing for all of us that they're just, he was a uniquely sinister man.
Yeah. Yeah. The book is absolutely fascinating. I would recommend this to anybody. The Infamous Harry Hayward, A True Account of Murder and Mesmerism in Gilded Age Minneapolis by Sean Francis Peters. Sean, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate it.
No, thank you. It was great speaking with you.
All right. What's next for you?
Oh, I don't know. I'm going to take a little break. Harry kind of wore me out a little. I've got a couple other things in the works, but there won't be another book exactly like this because there's only one Harry.